welcome. You're tuned into the best in true crime talk radio. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. That's Tim Dennis. Hello, Tim.
Hey.
Listen, I know you like when we can kind of stretch outside the bounds of our normal confinements of serial killers and madness.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And we've got a book today that's going to help us with that and an author joining us. Tom Clavin is a number one New York Times best-selling author and has worked as a newspaper and website editor, magazine writer, TV and radio commentator, and a reporter for the New York Times. He's received awards from the Society of Professional Journalists, Marine Corps Heritage Foundation, and National Newspaper Association. And his books include The Heart of Everything That Is, Halsey's Typhoon, and Reckless. He lives in Sag Harbor, New York, joining us today on the show to discuss his book coming out April 21st. Oh, it's out and available. Tombstone, The Earp Brothers, Doc Holliday, and The Vendetta Ride from Hell. Tom Clavin, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Great to have you here. You know, as Tim and I were mentioning at the beginning here, you know, we get a chance to cover a lot of true crime and strange stories of serial killers, mobsters and such. But I, like many of our listeners, are fascinated with the throwback to the Wild West and the days of old and the history behind it. And I just introduced some of my kids to the Tombstone movie about a month ago during the quarantine. Looking for movies to go through, I said, "You guys, we gotta sit down and watch some dad's favorite westerns," and we hit Tombstone, which then leads to 100 questions about how much of it is real, how much of it is blown up Hollywood hype. And when I saw this book and this story, I knew we had to have you on, Tom, because I figured this is great. It ties into true crime in a way we've never really covered on the show before, and gives us a chance to explore history. Kind of in an exciting new way as well. So thank you for doing this.
Well, thank you. And there's plenty of true crime in the whole Tombstone story. And you could even have a couple of, you know, even label a couple of the characters serial killers, because they were kind of sociopathic killers. Curly Bill Brosius, Johnny Ringo, some of the other crowd from that day and time, put a six gun in their hand and stay out of their way.
You know, we had a chance to sit down with Michael Biehn, who played Johnny Ringo in Tombstone.
Mm-hmm.
While we were in Tombstone, what was that, 2 years ago now, Tim?
Yeah, almost 2 years ago now.
Yeah. And he had a slightly different take. His version, he believes that Johnny Ringo wasn't the bad guy. He believed the Earps were really the criminals of Tombstone. And he had kind of an interesting narrative thread that he was telling us while we were visiting with him. And you know, I've read other things that kind of, you know, portray the Earps in a different light than the heroes, reluctant heroes that they always seem to be painted in a lot of the historical movies and documentaries. So I thought that's a fascinating aspect of this as well. But, you know, maybe you could, as we're going to talk about Tombstone and the Vendetta Ride from Hell that followed the bloody aftermath of that shootout, would you introduce us to the Earps and give us maybe a better overview of the Earps, their travels, and what brought them to Tombstone to begin with?
Well, the Earps in Tombstone were reluctant lawmen. And just going backtracking a little bit to what you talked about, your interview with Michael Biehn, who was an actor I've always liked very, very much, you know, going back even to the Terminator movies. But there was a kind of like the pendulum swung the other way in the 50s and 60s, and you know, maybe Westerns in general. But there was like this revisionist spin to Westerns, and that ended up including the Earps, where they were sort of seen as, well, maybe these are the guys who instigated the gunfight at the OK Corral, and maybe they were the bad guys. And in fact, if anybody, I don't know how many of your listeners may have seen it, but there's actually in the classic Trek, I guess it's called the first original Star Trek series, right, of Kirk and Spock and McCoy, there is an episode in which they replay the gunfight at the OK Corral, and Kirk and Spock and McCoy, and there's one other character there, I don't know if it's Scotty, whoever it is, there's a Chekhov, and they're actually the McLowrys and the Clantons up against these really bad guy Earp brothers who are forcing this fight to happen. So yeah, there was that, and I don't think I don't agree with that, but it is an interesting spin that things can, you know, like I said, the pendulum since then has sort of swung back to I think with my book, certainly trying to be a little more even-handed. There's also a book by Jeff Gwynne called The Last Gunfight that came out about 8 years ago, which also tries to be more even-handed and say, well, listen, the bad guy's not all bad. The good guys are not all good. But with the Earps, they were Tombstone represented a fresh start for them. Wyatt Earp had been a lawman with Bat Masterson in Dodge City when he left there. To his mind, he was leaving being a lawman for good. That wasn't necessarily what he set out to do with his with a career path. And he had this opportunity that five Earp brothers were going to reunite in Tombstone from different parts of where they were. I mean, Virgil and his wife were already in Arizona and Prescott. Morgan was newly married, living up in Montana. Young Warren Earp was at the family homestead in California looking to get out of the out from under his parents and go join his big brothers. And there was James Earp, who was the older of the two, Virgil and Wyatt, who was not a lawman at all, but he was a saloon keeper, at least in Tombstone. I mean, previous to that, he and his wife had been brothel owners. And so Tombstone was an opportunity for them. The town was booming. There had been a silver strike. And the brothers said, let's all get together. Let's pool our resources. Let's support and work hard together. And we'll become successful businessmen in Tombstone. So that was the plan. And as many times things go with plans, it didn't work out as they anticipated. And they became a reluctant lawman. They certainly did not want to be wearing badges and being on the side of like, well, we're the ones that are going to protect law and order Tombstone. Let other people do that. We want to become successful businessmen, but that's not how it worked out for them.
And this has such a rich tapestry of characters, you know, and people that were involved in this era. Was Tombstone unlike any other kind of West town at that point, or was it just like every other place? It just had the Earps and the OK Corral, which makes this story kind of rise to the top.
Well, Tombstone was both kind of a usual scenario and unique. And I'll explain what I mean by that. It was one of the last, if not the last, major boom towns in the American West. You'd had boom towns working as they keep, you know, prospectors got further west. And of course you had the boomtown areas of where the California gold strike had been in the 1848-49. But so in that regard, the Tombstone scenario of ore being found, in this case it was silver more than gold, and people rushing to it, like it happened in Deadwood, for example. And people rushing to it, and suddenly almost overnight you have a city. That was a familiar scenario by that point in time in the American West. What made it different is that Tombstone very quickly wanted to sort of skip past the Wild West part and go right to being a civilized, anticipating the 20th century kind of town. It billed itself as the San Francisco of the Southwest. It had churches and schools and theaters venues and French restaurants, Italian restaurants. It really saw itself as a sophisticated, only 3 or 4 years after it was founded. I mean, it had been a dot in the mountain, on the side of the mountains for hundreds of years. And then within 3 or 4 years after silver was discovered, it was a sophisticated a town and city. And I think that's why, I discussed this in the book. The gunfight at the OK Corral, one of the reasons why I think it was inevitable is because Tombstone sprang up so quickly. And suddenly, you still had the area populated by ranchers and cowboys who were used to doing the things they wanted to do and when they wanted to do it and without much law and order looking over them. And suddenly, almost overnight, you had this sophisticated city which was saying, we immediately want law and order. We want the riffraff, the cowboys, the corrupt ranchers done, out of here, don't bother us. So there was this very powerful friction that formed very quickly, and the Earps found themselves right in the middle of it.
This tension that was taking place, though, was it simply just power grabs, land grabs, looking for this fortune? Is that what drove it, or was it because it was, you know, a bar on every corner and, you know, kind of violent renegade times?
Well, it had been violent renegade times for you know, ever since the end of the Civil War in 1865, and you had the cowtowns springing up in Kansas, for example, which was Abilene and Wichita and Dodge City. And then you had the cowtowns in Texas too. And you had the cowboys. That was a derogatory term. It was originally spelled with a hyphen, COW-BOY. And it was almost like an insult. It's like, you can't do anything else but, you know, steer cows on a 1,000-mile trail all through Texas up into Kansas. That's all you're good for. And all you're good for when you're off the trail is for getting drunk and whoring and shooting your gun and having hangovers and then getting yourself broke and having to start all over again. So the Texas Rangers had kicked the cowboys out, and then New Mexico kicked them out into Arizona. So you had Arizona for the cowboys and for others who were trying to escape, you know, the long arm of the law was their last refuge. And yet Arizona was also a place that was being settled. You had people coming from the west, from California, to settle it. You had people coming from the east. You had people coming down from Colorado to settle it. So it was a cauldron of all these competing forces. And you had people like forming new counties and forming new cities like Tombstone and electing their lawmakers and their councils and appointing and electing sheriffs and marshals. And everything happened so quickly that these different elements, the lawless elements, the ranchers, the cattle rustlers, the horse thieves, the sheriffs, the marshals, the churchgoers, the people wanting to raise their families, all got thrown together into this cauldron within such a short period of time that really you could say that there was going to be some kind of explosive conflict, which the gunfight at the OK Corral was, and to the shock of everybody, was kind of inevitable.
And what can you tell us regarding the legend of Doc Holliday and who he was? I know in a lot of the movies, they, you know, he's just already kind of there and it seems glossed over, but he's a central part of this story, but without much understanding of who he was, other than he seemed to be held in kind of high regards as a legend himself. Who was Doc Holliday?
Doc Holliday is such an intriguing character, and he was born in Georgia. His father had been, you know, a heroic fighter for the South in the Civil War when Doc was a young youngster. And Doc had gone to dentistry school, and he probably would have, you know, if things had worked out differently, spent the rest of his life in with somewhat of an aristocratic life in the post-Civil War era in Georgia. But he had the misfortune of developing, what's commonly referred to as tuberculosis. I don't know if that's precisely what the lung ailment was that he had, but he was told pretty standard advice at that time, well, the only chance you have of extending your life is you have to find a climate that's dry and warm. So he gradually worked his way west. There was somebody he was very much in love with that he had to, you know, basically leave her behind. He couldn't, you know, impose upon her this terrible life that he was now having to lead. And he worked his way west and then in Texas. It was in Texas that he first met Wyatt Earp. And Wyatt was basically the only friend Doc had. He was a very unhappy, bitter man, a gambler, a drunkard. He had a certain code of honor. And in the case of Wyatt Earp, it was like, Wyatt, you've befriended me, so I will take a bullet for you. I wouldn't for anybody else on this planet, but Wyatt, I will for you. So he sort of followed Wyatt up to Dodge City when Wyatt was the deputy marshal there. When Wyatt went out to Arizona, Doc, in the company of his girlfriend, Big Nose, Kate Elder, eventually found his way to Tombstone to follow Wyatt and the other Earps there. And again, he was not well-liked. He was not well-regarded. He was not respected, but he was feared because of his volatile temper, which only got worse when he was drinking. He always carried a knife. In fact, he had killed a man in Texas with a knife. He always, when allowed to, he carried a gun, and he was quick to take out his gun. The saving grace there was that he was a bad marksman. So he could fire or empty a pistol and still not hit anybody, which is, you know, just as a footnote, that's why he was the one with the shotgun at the OK Corral. so he, he was this pretty despicable character, but he had a certain charm to him, and people feared him. And for whatever reason, Wyatt was his only friend. Wyatt stayed loyal to Doc. Wyatt would later say that Doc saved his life a couple of occasions, and that's there's probably some truth to at least one of those occasions. But even so, it was a lot for just it says a lot for Wyatt that he could put up with Doc when nobody else except maybe Big Nose Kate could put up with him.
All right, so we've got this ragtag team. How do they end up becoming, you know, these reluctant lawmen at this point? If it's something they wanted to avoid and just go about their business and settling it, why not just avoid the nonsense altogether? Or was it that specter of Wyatt's background and the lawman, you know, background of the Earps that kind of superseded them?
Well, you know, when I was writing the book, I kept, especially about Wyatt, I was hearing that line, that one of the most famous lines from the movie Godfather 2, and Michael Corleone says, "Every time you think you're out, they drag you back in." And that's what the Tombstone was, Wyatt Earp's Don Corleone, you know, Michael Corleone moment.
Okay.
That's one way to put it, I suppose. But I mean, Virgil had, like I said, had been there first, and he got the other brothers to join them. They had tried to go into business. They had invested in some silver mines. The investments were not disasters, but they weren't profitable either. The businesses they tried, they were a little too late to get into, like, the freight hauling business because people were already there. And so Virgil was the first one really to become, he was a deputy U.S. Marshal. Then he eventually became Marshal of Tombstone. It was a way to make a living. And what he would do is if he needed a posse, he would, you know, deputize Morgan and Wyatt. Wyatt spent some time as a deputy marshal, spent some time as a deputy sheriff. Again, it was like he kept getting pulled back in because that's what he knew how to do. And when he tried to do something else, it wasn't successful. So he sort of fell back on what he knew how to do. And he had a reputation, a good reputation as a lawman from Dodge City. So it was the kind of thing where in the absence of more effective policing, let's say, especially the sheriff of Cochise County, Johnny Behan, he was in line really in league with the cowboys and the corrupt ranchers. It was sort of like the de facto law and order, you know, group in Tombstone increasingly was viewed as Virgil and his brothers. Virgil at the top of the heap because he was the legitimate lawman. He was the marshal of Tombstone. But he always, if he needed backup, who else would he turn to but the people he trusted most in the world? And those were his brothers, Virgil and Morgan, and they knew how to handle guns. So as the tension increased between the cowboys and the ranchers and those who wanted the Wild West to stay wild, they didn't want to have law and order that would infringe on their right to cross the Mexican border and steal cattle and rebrand them and sell them to the army, for example. The resistance that they were doing to the law and order, and then you had the law and order desire on the people of Tombstone, but they couldn't trust their own duly elected people to enforce law and order. So the Earps were, you know, reluctant is the word. We don't want this responsibility. You people take care of it. But it kept getting thrown back at them, and gradually the cowboys and the ranchers. That's the way they saw the Earps themselves. I mean, it was one thing if you had the people of Tombstone seeing the Earps that way. But when the ranchers and the rustlers and the cowboys and you know, people like Johnny Ringo and Curly Bill Brosius started to say, oh, you know, if the Earps were gone, then we'd have nothing to worry about. That's where the Earps realized that they had bullseye on their backs. And they realized, you know what, we don't want to fight anybody. We don't want to be in the middle of this thing. But we do have to realize that we might have to someday.
So just in being who they were created this tension with the people that were looking for the free, easier ride.
It did. And the Earp brothers were very clannish. You know, they always trusted each other above anybody else. So they sort of had, I don't know if a chip on their shoulder is the way to put it, because it's got kind of a negative connotation. But we're the Earps. You know, we know we can trust each other. We don't trust anybody else as much as we trust each other. And we have honor, family honor to protect, even though it wasn't like they were an aristocratic family. They had quite a few lawbreakers in their family tree. So they rub some people the wrong way. They could seem a little bit arrogant, a little bit haughty, and they certainly rubbed the cowboys and the mischief makers the wrong way.
All right. Now talk to us a little bit about who Johnny Ringo and Brocious were. You know, what type of guys were they? What were they? Were they running in packs of dangerous outlaws? Or, you know, at that time, was it even really considered outlaw? I mean, everybody was just kind of doing their best to carve their way, even though in today's vision, we'd look back and say, yeah, they're stealing cattle, they're doing these things. But, you know, at some points in history, you know, this was just kind of how you survived.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, one of the things I found when I was doing research for, you know, what has turned out to be a frontier lawman trilogy, Wild Bill, Dodge City, and now Tombstone, is that, you know, the idea of the good guys, you could tell them right away because they wore the white hats and the bad guys wore the black hats. That didn't apply most of the time because it was in the West after the Civil War, there was a lot of gray areas. You could have somebody who, you know, he could be one year, he could be a deputy sheriff somewhere, and the next year he could be serving 3 months in prison for being part of a robbery. And the year after that, he's serving as a constable in some Colorado town. You know, they crossed the line back and forth. Even Curly Bill Brocious. Now, Curly Bill Brocious was pretty much considered a sociopath. He liked cruelty, and he liked, you know, there's a story about when he and a friend of his got drunk and they came upon a church where a dance was being held, and they burst into the church and they told everybody who was dancing at gunpoint, take your clothes off. We want to. They just laughed it up while they saw people dancing, feared for their lives, dancing naked. You know? And that's the kind of weirdo he was. And he would shoot people just because they looked at him the wrong way. But there was also a point which I talk about in the book, where he was the Cochise County receiver of taxes. he had this position where he went with the sheriff out there to make sure people paid their taxes. That was his job. So it's you know, you people were constantly crossing the line from one side to the other. But there was no doubt that Curly Bill was not a good guy. Johnny Ringo, you know, there's more legends about Johnny Ringo than Curly Bill. I mean, there's legend that Johnny Ringo was a very educated man who was a very well-read man. Not necessarily true, but that was a legend about him. And he also was somebody who suffered from severe depression. Now, who knew about depression or manic depression in the 1870s and 1880s? But he apparently had some kind of health, mental health ailment that really troubled him. So there would be times when he would be, you know, a friendly guy, and there would be times when he'd be terribly depressed, and there'd be times when he'd just shoot somebody because he wanted to shoot them. So definitely colorful characters. And then Tombstone, that area of Arizona was like the last refuge for some of these characters, because like I said, they had been kicked out of Texas, kicked out of New Mexico. They couldn't go any farther west because then you're going to be up against California, which was all done with that whole Wild West scene by the early 1880s. So they had to hold on to the Tombstone. It represented for them a chance to keep the Old West alive, which meant a refuge for them from law and order and watching the West pass them by.
Now, from the time that the Earps came to settle there in Tombstone until the moment of the confrontation at the OK Corral, how long a period of time are we really talking about? Obviously, the movies always make it look like it ramps up pretty quickly. But what's the reality behind that?
Well, Wyatt Earp left Dodge City and at about the same time Doc Holliday did in 1879. And that was a couple of years after the guy named Ed Schieffelin had first found some silver. And by 1879, Tombstone was a boom town. So when Wyatt and the other brothers all reunited there in late 1879, Tombstone is well established as a boom town and was growing by leaps and bounds. Like I said, the restaurants were opening up, the hotels were opening up. And the gunfight at the OK Corral was October 1881. So you're not talking about a long period of time. You're talking about a relatively short period of time that the Earps came to Tombstone and found themselves in a really uncomfortable position they had not sought of representing law and order faction. So So one of the things that I was glad to find out about when I was working on the book is that you don't have to have these long stretches of time that you're accounting for that nothing might have been happening. Tombstone was a very happening place, and things were always going on. They could be weather related, you know, floods and of course, record breaking heat. You have stagecoach robberies going on. You have colorful characters passing through. Cattle rustling. You had almost a war broke out between the United States and Mexico because of the abusive way that some of the Arizona ranchers were just blatantly going these night raids across the border and stealing large amounts of cattle and bringing them back across into Arizona territory. So in a it's really a relatively short period of time, maybe 2 years, just a little over 2 years from the time the Earps show up to the end of the Vendetta ride. So there's a lot packed into a short period of time.
And during this time, you know, is there quite a bit of confrontation between the cowboys, the bad guys, Curly Bill and Johnny Ringo and the Earps, or do they each kind of come in their own little sections?
Well, it becomes the momentum builds, you know, as you get into, you know, 1880 turns into 1881, there's a rushing towards the inevitable kind of feeling in Tombstone, because you have more stagecoach robberies, you have more cattle being rustled, you have higher tensions between the United States and Mexico, which even, you know, had to get the federal government in Washington involved, basically saying to the cowboys in Tombstone, listen, you guys got to stop it. You know, we're going to be at war with Mexico, and we don't want to go to war with Mexico. We're still trying to pay off the Civil War. And then you'd have increasing confrontations between Curly Bill and the cowboy faction he led, and Johnny Ringo and the faction that he and Curly Bill basically led together, and the citizenry, and the citizenry coming to more and more expect protection from law and order from their sheriff's department. So
was the real problem then that it was that this is kind of the base that these guys called home, and that they were going out creating problems that they were bringing back to Tombstone. So it became an inevitability that it wasn't even like, you know, we have to do this. It's you know, they're bringing a war and bringing a fight right to our doorstep because of their actions.
You know, it's a good question, because I think my sense of it and what I tried to, you know, illustrate in the book is that each side thought the other was causing the problem. It wasn't even the ranchers who were buying stolen cattle and rebranding it. I mean, they thought that by itself is not the problem. That's how they saw that, as being fulfilling demand. What I mean by that is that you had this growing boom town, and in general, southeastern Arizona was booming. And you had the army forts there. There was a great demand for beef. And in such a short amount of time, you just couldn't raise that much cattle so fast. So the ranchers believed, okay, listen, we're not harming anybody. We're just stealing the cattle from Mexico. And we're rustling them across the border, we're rebranding them, and then we're selling them to the army and to the butcher shops and restaurants at Tombstone. Everybody should be happy. We're providing a service here that's very much needed. And so they said it's the law and order faction that's trying to stop what we're doing and sit on us and not allow us to make a living and run our ranches the way we think they should be run. It's their problem. And then, of course, the law and order faction in Tombstone is saying, how can we have people stealing cattle and stealing horses and having shootouts on Saturday nights in the saloons when we're trying to raise families and we're trying to, you know, build churches and build schools and have people come from businesses start up and come from elsewhere in the country to enjoy the prosperity that Tombstone promises. It's their problem. It's the fault of the Cowboys. If we could just get rid of them, everything will be fine. So each side really thought that the other side was the problem and that they had, I don't know if right on their side, if that's quite the right word, but they felt justified for the way they were acting, what they were doing. And that, as you know, when you have two sides that don't reflect well enough on them, self-reflect on, maybe I'm part of the problem here. Well, they're going to clash.
Now, in the movie, of course, it seems like the Earps are reluctant through most of this to really get their hands dirty or involve it. But it's not until the Earps themselves become violated by this that they fully throw down and decide this is war. This is we all have to come together. How close to reality is that?
Well, it's pretty close because the Earps began to feel increasingly threatened, not only because they knew that they had, without their intention, they had become like the figureheads. They had become the visible representation of the Law and Order faction in Tombstone. So they knew that there were bullseyes on their backs. So they sort of circled the wagons a bit. They weren't looking for the confrontation, but they had to recognize, one could happen. But they also were blatantly threatened. I mean, just very in the 24 hours and before the gunfight at the OK Corral, you had Ike Clanton, who had a problem with alcohol and a problem with being a boastful big mouth bully. And he's going around town and carrying a gun. And to anybody who will listen, he's talking about that we're going to get revenge on the Earps for what transgression. We don't know what thick one. And we're going to take care of the Earps once and for all, and we're going to get rid of the Earps as if you were getting rid of some kind of infection. We got to get this infection out of Tombstone, and everything will be back to the way it was, the good old days. So the Earps knew that there was going to be a problem, and they did not, from everything that we know about the story and the research, eyewitness accounts, things like that, they did not go in search of the McLowry brothers and the Clanton brothers with the idea like, okay, let's kill them and get this over with. On that particular day, which is October 26, 1881, the McLowrys and the Clanton brothers, two brothers each, were in this vacant lot, not in the OK Corral, but a vacant lot, and basically were told, either you can stay in Tombstone and surrender your guns, or you got to leave Tombstone. And they were doing neither one. They were just standing there basically saying, all right, come and get us. Let's try and settle this thing once and for all. So Virgil, he had no choice. I mean, he was the marshal of Tombstone. You have the mayor right there. You have the city council. They're basically saying, Virgil, do your job. You can't just let him hang out indefinitely. It looks bad. And so when Virgil had to go do his job, which was to disarm four armed men, he could think of nobody better or he trusted more than his own brothers, Wyatt and Morgan, to deputize for this particular mission.
This shootout. Now, when Tim and I visited, there seemed to be discussion about whether it actually took place at the OK Corral at all, or outside of the OK Corral. Maybe you could lead us up to that day and what happened and what led to this eventual confrontation and where this gunfight actually took place.
One of the almost amusing things about the events leading up to the gunfight is that the night before, you had a poker game in one of the saloons that included Virgil Earp, the marshal of Tombstone, that included Johnny Behan, who was the sheriff of Cochise County, and Ike Clanton. So, these people all didn't despise each other. They might not have liked each other terribly much, but they could still sit down with a couple other guys, and they played all night. And then when it was just about dawn, Johnny went home to his place to sleep and Virgil went home to his wife and his home to sleep. But Clanton kept drinking and some, switch was thrown in his head that he started going around the town with a gun and saying it's time to get rid of these Earps. And right that same morning is when, totally unrelated, Billy Clanton came into town and Tom and Frank McLowry came into town. They were going to take care of transact some business, and then they had a sibling, I think, back in Iowa who was getting married. They were about to leave town. And by this time, Virgil, who was pretty angry because he had been waken out of a sound sleep, to go arrest Ike. He knocked him over the head with his pistol, dragged him off to jail. So the Billy Clanton and the McLowrys heard that Ike had, what they version they were told is Ike had been mishandled rudely. Let's put it that way. And so then there was a confrontation that involved a brief fist fight between Wyatt Earp and Tom McLowry. And McLowry felt ill-used, that he had been preyed upon by Wyatt Earp. So they got their guns, which they were not supposed to have within the city limits, and they were in this vacant lot. It was not the OK Corral. They were in this vacant lot that was only about like 15 feet wide. And it was almost like they were partly thinking, well, let's have this confrontation and get it over with. And they were partly not sure what to think. You know, you had these four guys that were just milling about saying, well, what do we do? Should we have a fight? Should we not have a fight? Should we just go home? Ike, you know, can you sober up? And maybe we'll just go home and talk about this a little bit more. And it was while they were deliberating or not sure what to do with themselves, that's when, you know, Virgil said, I've got to disarm these guys. That's my job. And he appoints Wyatt and Morgan as deputies. And then Doc shows up, because Doc had heard about a possible confrontation, and he was upset that Wyatt would go on this adventure, which is what Doc saw it as being, and not take him along. I mean, why? How possibly could Wyatt go into possibly combat and not have his right-hand guy, Doc Holliday, with him? So Doc showed up, put a guilt trip on Wyatt, and said, "How you can't do this without me? This is terrible. How can you do this to me, your friend?" And what's also kind of funny is that so Virgil sort of deputizes Doc. He really had to sort of hold his nose while he did it. You can imagine Doc Holliday wearing a badge. But then he says to Doc, I want you to touch your pistol. Here's a shotgun. Because the Earps all knew that Doc could hit the broadside of a barn with a pistol. So they hand him a shotgun. And said, well, he might be, even it's kind of hard not to hit something with a shotgun. So if we end up shooting, you know, Doc might be able to do some good. And then they marched down the street towards this vacant lot where they were told that the four guys were hanging out, not sure what they were doing out there. And then comes a crucial part of this whole thing is that, you know, Johnny Behan, the sheriff, he could have diffused the whole situation by talking to the ranchers and the McLowrys and the Clan, say, listen, give me your guns, or could you just leave, fellas? He waits till the last second to do this. And then there's some kind of miscommunication because he talks to them. He comes back to the Earps, and he seems to indicate to Virgil that he disarmed them, that he disarmed the McLowry brothers and the Clanton brothers. So the Earps continued to that lot, not expecting violence. They just went there to accompany Virgil, who was going to basically say, listen, here's your horses. Go ahead and leave. You know, no harm done. I'll send somebody out to your ranch with your guns, and there'll be no confrontation. So, but what happens is they get to the vacant lot. Like I said, it's only about 15 feet wide. They're in close quarters with each other, and to their surprise, they find the McLowrys and the Clantons still have their guns. What's with that? Well, the only reason they must still have their guns is because they intend to have a gunfight. And even at that last point, Virgil's trying, you know, when the guns are being drawn, he's holding up his hands and he says, "This, I don't want this." You know, he was not seeking this confrontation. But by then, there's this explosion of violence. Of you know, you mentioned the movies, how they portray things. In most cases, you know, you look at the movie called The Gunfight, The OK Corral, or John Ford's classic, My Darling Clementine. The whole last 15-minute climactic part of the movie is this ongoing running gun battle. People are hiding behind buildings and water barrels, things like that. The real gunfight was 30 bullets were fired in 30 seconds. That's a really intense firefight. And you're talking about, you know, eight guys in one small vacant lot, 30 bullets, 30 seconds. It's a wonder that any of them survived.
Now, it didn't take place at the OK Corral. You said it took place in a vacant lot. How does it get associated with the OK Corral to begin with?
That was something that I think, you know, in later on, like in the 20s and 30s, they started doing something called Hell Dorado in Tombstone, which was basically an opportunity to bring in some tourist dollars. You know, Tombstone had been a boom town and then a bust town, BUST, you know, its silver mines eventually flooded and emptied out, and that foundation for its prosperity was gone. And Tombstone had to cling to survival for decades. But, legends came up about it, and they start these reenactments of the gunfight at the OK Corral. And the OK Corral was a bigger space. You could do a reenactment in the OK. Yeah, you're not going to do – it really wasn't that impressive to do a reenactment with guys in a small 15-foot-wide alley. That seemed kind of cheesy. So it became the gunfight at the OK Corral.
So that was just marketing.
Marketing. And I don't blame them for it. I don't at all. I mean, Tombstone needed the Tombstone has always built itself as the town that would not die, and it refused to, because some of its other economies were faltering or gone. It refused to die. If it could hold these festivals and these wild west rodeos and reenactments that brought people from all over the country to see them and make a way that people could make a living and have jobs, go for it. There's really no harm done. I mean, to do something like that, even though you're playing a little bit with the facts.
All right, this 30-second gunfight, 30 bullets go flying. How many people are dead? How many are wounded? What's the story?
Well, you have three people wounded, three people dead of the eight participants. Now, I have to say eight participants with a bit of an asterisk here, because once the gunfight began, Ike Clanton, who was really the catalyst for it by his ranting and threats that were made all over Tombstone that he was going to take care of the Earps, he actually runs at Wyatt Earp and grabs him, embraces him, basically saying, "Wyatt, protect me." And Wyatt's like, "Get away from me, you know, get a gun and do something or get out of here." And Clanton takes off. Ike just keeps running. They found him later. So you have his brother Billy and Tom and Frank McLowry are firing their guns. And then you have Wyatt, Virgil, Morgan, and Doc firing their guns, Doc with a shotgun. And the McLowrys and Billy Clanton are all killed. And Morgan, Virgil, and Doc are wounded. Doc slightly. Virgil and Morgan more seriously. Morgan gets hit in the shoulder, and Virgil gets hit in the thigh, I believe it is. And so they're more serious wounds. Wyatt Earp is the only one in the actual gunfight where the bullets are flying who was unscathed. And it wasn't like he was hiding somewhere. He was just standing straight up as everybody else and firing his gun. And they're part of the legend or the myth, whatever you want to call it, of Wyatt Earp, is that he got through this extremely intense firefight and not a bullet touched him.
So almost like he is a chosen one.
Yeah, you can look at it that way. And later on in the story, in my book Tombstone, when he's on the Earp Vendetta ride, he also stumbles into an ambush, and there's a whole bunch of people that are firing at him, and he only takes a bullet in the heel of his boot. So it was pretty remarkable that Wyatt Earp could be in some of these confrontations and never got even wounded.
Now, once this has been settled, the shots are fired, there's death, there's, you know, some injuries, they settle. Do things start to calm down in Tombstone, or has this opened up a whole new kettle of fish?
Well, it's sort of both. I mean, I'll tell you what I mean by that, is that certainly the people in Tombstone were shocked at what happened. They, again, billing themselves San Francisco, the Southwest, they thought they were past this. And yet here you have this brutal explosion of violence on October 26, 1881. The immediate aftermath of that, which again, a lot of times the movie versions have completely overlooked, is that the Earps and Doc were arrested for murder. And only Doc and Wyatt were part of the courtroom inquisition or inquest or whatever you want to call it, because Morgan and Virgil were deemed to be wounded too severely to actually be part of the trial. They were allowed to continue to recover at their homes. And so Wyatt, and this legal proceeding lasted a month before Judge Wells Spicer, and there were a whole bunch of witnesses and testimonies, and you know the reason why this is it is kind of a courtroom thriller that takes place between two explosions of violence, in that if it had been found, the judge had found that Wyatt and Doc were to actually, there was enough there to remand them over to go on trial, that could have been the end of Wyatt Earp and Doc Holliday, because they could have been judged guilty. They could have spent the rest of their lives in prison or even hung right. for murder. So it, you know, it's really remarkable the story did not go in that direction. But it did seem, at least, that the gunfight coupled with the trial, the very thorough legal proceeding that was held, okay, once that was done, it's past us. Let's move on. It's going to be 1882 soon. Let's move on. But Ike Clanton, who had, again, run away from the confrontation that could have settled things, he was still agitating with some of his cowboy and rancher friends. And so they ambushed Virgil, who had remained the marshal when he recovered. He was still a marshal at Tombstone. A few days after Christmas, they ambushed him with shotguns. They wounded him very severely, crippled his left arm for life. And even though he recovered, it was still a horrible attack. And the Earps, the remaining Earps, all moved into like a hotel to circle the wagons, take care of each other. And that went on for 2 or 3 months. And then they thought, okay, everything's calmed down now. Maybe Virgil took the hit for all of us and there won't be any further problem. And then on March, I believe it was March 18th of 1882, Wyatt and Morgan decide, oh, you know, it's okay to go out and shoot some pool. We think things have died down now. And while they're shooting pool, there's a couple of, you know, the window behind Morgan shatters, a couple of shots ring out, and Morgan is shot in the back, and he dies right there on the pool table. And that's when Doc comes running to see what the commotion is, and that's when Wyatt and Doc share this moment. They look at each other like, okay, we know now that there's going to be only way this thing is going to be settled is if we settle it. And that becomes the foundation of the Earp, what's called the Earp Vendetta Ride.
Did they expect going out that this was going to be something that they were going to be coming back from, or were they both reserved to the fact that this was probably the last run?
I think that Wyatt knew that he was burning a bridge. whether they could come back to Tombstone or not was not Wyatt's priority. But I think if he gave it any consideration, it was like, I'm probably having to never come back here again. You know, he had a sidebar to this is that's kind of a impact on the overall story, is that Wyatt by this time had fallen in love with Josephine Marcus, who had been the fiance of the sheriff, Johnny Behan. So he had that kind of personal aspect to the larger story. He had already sent her away, you know, with the concern that there might be some, well, he knew that the Earps were a target. And it's kind of amusing, but Wyatt didn't send his wife away. He sent his girlfriend away to be out of harm's way.
Wow.
Something happens to my wife. It's too bad, but I sure don't want something to happen to my girlfriend. So he sends her to stay with her family in San Francisco. And, so Virgil was had left Tombstone to go to California. Morgan was dead. He had the other two people that were important to him in the town were his brother Warren and his friend Doc Holliday. Well, they saddled up with him to go on this vengeance ride. So there really wasn't much to come back to. If he was going to do a scorched earth policy after that, so be it. And if he never got back to Tombstone, so be it. It had lost, you know, he'd gone there with such promise, with such hope, to be back with his brothers, to become a successful businessman. None of that had panned out. One brother was now crippled and one was dead.
This vengeance ride, so how many people total go on it?
Yeah, Wyatt, Doc, Warren, and I think there were four other men, and there were a couple others who sided with Wyatt, who sort of joined it for a time, left, came back, joined it again. But basically, there were about seven men who were part of this posse, and it wasn't a completely illegal vendetta vigilante action, because after Virgil had gotten severely wounded, the marshal in charge of federal marshals in Arizona, a man named Crawley Dake, he appointed Wyatt as the deputy federal marshal. Virgil had been both the marshal of Tombstone and a federal deputy marshal. So Wyatt had been appointed a federal deputy marshal, so he did have some legal foundation for coming up with a posse, although his posse was not intended to arrest the bad guys and bring them back for trial. He was out to exact vengeance, which was not Wyatt's way. He was not a brutal, violent man, but he had been pushed. A line had been crossed, and he was going to go chase down these guys, who included, it turned out, Curly Bill Brosius. But then Sheriff Johnny Behan, suddenly, you know, thinking that I've got to do my job, he formed a posse that went in search or trailed Wyatt's posse. And then it gets to be like Keystone Cops, because then the authorities said, wait a minute, the Behan posse is not quite legal. They formed a third posse to chase Behan's posse, which was chasing Wyatt's posse. So, you have these groups.
It's like the Keystone Cops.
I know. They're riding around, southeast Arizona trying to catch each other. Now, in the case of Wyatt and Doc and Warren and their crew, they always managed to stay one step ahead. And, you know, they ended up, there were at least three men who were killed by Wyatt's vendetta ride. And there could have been more, but by then, any of the other men who may have had anything to do with the shootings of the Earp brothers had either left Arizona or so well hidden. You also had Wyatt knew he was running out of time, because he was either going to have to leave Arizona or turn himself in. You know, one way or the other, what he was doing was not completely legal, especially since when they found somebody that might have been implicated in the shootings, they just killed him instead of arresting them. So at some point, the vendetta ride really lasted for a couple of weeks. And then by that point, everybody else was hiding or dead. And that's when Doc and Wyatt said, let's get out of here. Let's leave Arizona. And they did. And Wyatt never came back to Tombstone. He would find his girlfriend in San Francisco, Josephine Marcus, who became the fourth Mrs. Earp.
This is, I mean, you understand why legends like Wyatt Earp have lived on, right? I mean, this guy just seemed like he was in the right place at the wrong time all the time. And yeah, you come out and the smoke clears and you're still standing there. It makes him look like a Paul Bunyan, right? I mean, this larger than life imposing figure that just, just lives on.
Right. Well, and I alluded to it before, you know, when they're on their vendetta ride, there comes a point where Wyatt is out in front of the others and he rides into an ambush that's orchestrated by Curly Bill Brosius. So this Curly Bill Brosius, one of the baddest bad guys that there is, with his, you know, corrupt cowboys and bad guys, and they're all firing away at Wyatt, and Wyatt's got bullets flying all around him. He takes his shotgun out and kills Curly Bill and then manages to get back, get behind some rocks without the only bullet, like I said, it landed in his boot heel. So, you know, there is something to be said about sometimes you become a legend because you have great luck. And Wyatt was just untouched. There turned out to be, you know, Wild Bill Hickok had always believed during his lifetime that there was not been a bullet made that would kill him. He turned out to be wrong in Deadwood. But in Wyatt's case, there did not turn out to be a bullet that would kill him.
Well, what happens to our heroes of this story as time progresses? I mean, you know, what are their eventual ends?
Well, Doc, he left, with Wyatt. They left Arizona. They went up to Colorado. They had a dispute, which meant that they parted ways for a couple of years, but then reunited when Doc's health was deteriorating, and so they, you know, had their kissing and making up, so to speak, before Doc died. He was only, I think, 36 when Doc died in Colorado. We know Morgan died, Virgil, And Wyatt crossed paths several times for the rest of their lives, even though Virgil was, they were still looking to be successful businessmen. It always eluded them. Wyatt, when he married Josephine, it seemed like he finally got it right with his fourth wife because they were together for 43 years. They wandered all over the country, you know, New Mexico, California, Colorado. Wyatt even ran a saloon in Alaska for a few years. He sold real estate in San Diego. His last few years, Wyatt and Josephine lived in Los Angeles, and he was making money as a consultant to silent westerns that were being made in Hollywood. And he became a protege or you know, became a mentor to a young, talented silent film director named John Ford. And Wyatt died. It was it's a couple of months from his 81st birthday in Los Angeles. He had attempted a few times to write a or cooperate with a biography of his life, but the people who approached him always wanted to sensationalize it. They wanted to be, you know, there's that famous line from the Man Who Shot Liberty Valance when legend becomes the fact, print the legend or something like that. And he didn't want to cooperate with a book that wasn't going to tell things as they really were. So he died never having had that opportunity. And then once he was dead, people could make up whatever they wanted, which is a lot of times what they did.
How hard is it for you to go back with all of these legends and lore and sift through to get to the real story in these cases, or as close as you can?
Well, first of all, I want to emphasize that it's fun. You know, I don't want to make it seem like I'm a suffering writer here. This was a terrible chore. You're dealing with these mythical people from our history, and it is fun to write about this time period in the American West and these colorful characters. But yes, it is difficult because there have been so many embellishments and fictions and contradictions. And, you know, fortunately, in Tombstone at that time, there was both the Tombstone Nugget and the Tombstone Epitaph. You have archives existing of reporting going on as things were happening. You have journals that have survived and diaries that were kept by people who were observing and witnesses to events that were happening. So, sifting is the right word. It is sort of like every day you're down by the river, you're prospecting and you're sifting, you know, sifting through your net and then at the end of the day, if you're lucky, you have some nuggets, you have some gold that you could actually, it's actually valuable, but you've allowed a lot of sand to sift through that was kind of worthless too.
I know that you spend time, you've got this trilogy, right? Dodge City, Wyatt Earp, Bat Masterson, Wild Bill, The True Story of America's Frontier's First Gunfighter, Tombstone, The Earp Brothers, Doc Holliday, and Vendetta Ride from Hell we're talking about today. Of all of these characters, you know, again, is their story, how much of it has been blown out of proportion creating these epic hero-like characters? Or, you know, as opposed to what they really were ordinary men in extraordinary circumstances.
You know, I think in the case of Wyatt Earp, he is often thought of as a gunfighter, and he wasn't. He was not a killer. He was not a cold-blooded guy. He was kind of known for being quiet and reserved and not an extrovert by any means. And it could be considered kind of a cold person. You know, it's people that were cringed if he turned that cold blue-eyed stare on you. But he was not a gunfighter. So I think I find him a kind of a sympathetic character because a couple of times he found himself in situations he didn't want to be in, but he didn't run from it. He took on responsibility. Doc Holliday's a fascinating character. I think somebody we've hardly touched upon, Bat Masterson, is a character I really, really love. And he's most... He actually, you know, a lot of the book Dodge City is about the relationship and the great friendship between Wyatt and Bat when they were lawmen together, young lawmen together in Dodge City. But Bat also makes an appearance in Tombstone. When Wyatt saw things getting more and more dangerous, he sent out a signal basically to Bat, said, "I need your help." And Bat right away came to Tombstone because they were great friends. And it's very, very possible that Bat Masterson would have been one of the members in that gunfight at the OK Corral, except he got a telegram that his own brother, Jim, who had become the marshal of Dodge City, was there were assassins out to get him. So Bat jumped on the first train and made his way back to Dodge City, where he did arrive in time to save his brother's life. But he would have been, I think, a participant in the OK Corral gunfight. So he's a fascinating character that had, you know, one of these more than one life in the American West and in American history. So that's what I go back to what I just said recently. It's fun because and the best part about it is that when you do the research and you find out what really happened, when you discover that it's as exciting, if not more exciting, than the embellishments of the fictions. So it's sort of like you can have your cake and eat it too. You could tell a good story, but know that you're basing it on the facts.
There's a lot said with these legends of the villains, if you will, the Jesse James, the Billy the Kids and things, and everyone seeming to have survived Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. You know, these famous tales of these legendary outlaws who end up getting gunned down, but yet they survive. There might be more to it. And we actually have a story we're going to be exploring again in a few weeks regarding Jesse James. But what do you make of this? What is this fascination with the Wild West that here, even in the 21st century, people are still fascinated by those characters and the fact that could they have really faked their own deaths and been a part of some conspiracy to allow these criminals to go on and try to lead normal lives at some point?
Well, I think that there's a romanticism to them, that it was a simpler, less complicated time. And yes, it probably was. I mean, the 1870s and 1880s had to be a lot less complicated than the days of the internet and cell phones and space satellites and all kinds of things, and, you know, living in a country with 330 million people. So yes, it was a simpler time. I think we sort of overlooked that it was a much rougher time. I mean, just think what it was like to live without the transportation we have today, for example, and without the ability to treat illnesses and diseases that you know, polio and smallpox was rampant back in those days. We don't have it now. But you had these colorful characters, especially after the Civil War, that did roam the West and did have adventures. I mean, Wild Bill Hickok, from the time that he got out of the Union Army in 1865 and headed farther and farther west, he had a lot of great adventures as an Army scout, as a lawman, as a deputy U.S. Marshal. And he encountered people like Frank and Jesse James and Billy the Kid and some of these other outlaws. He had the long hair and the mustache and wore the buckskin. He had this exotic allure to him and appearance. So it's not like you're building up people who don't deserve it or who didn't earn their notoriety. They did. They did extraordinary things. Now, in the case of some of them, they were bad things. You know, I mean, some of them were train robbers. Some of them were killers, you know. But they were, even if some of their stories were embellished, they were still, for the most part, genuine characters. You know, the female outlaw Belle Starr was a genuine character. And you know, someday maybe I'll get to explore her life because she really is remarkable. But she's an example of, you know, you may have added a couple of things here or there, but the foundation was intact.
It's remarkable to know about this part of our history and to hear these stories and realize that, you know, I mean, we feel far removed from it. We're not really that far removed from that part of our history. And, you know, that these legends still capture us and that you can make movies about them every 6 to 10 years and people are just as fascinated by that really speaks to that era, right? I mean, you brought up a great point. You know, it's a totally different time and this kind of weird innocence of our country at that point, but yet it was a very dark time. And
it
these
was,
characters
yeah.
seem to transcend history and be, you know, like Olympian gods in a sense.
Yeah, I'm glad you put it that way, because right in my author's note at the beginning of Tombstone, I refer to the gunfight at the OK Corral and the Earp Vendetta ride as like our Iliad and Odyssey. you know, what the Greeks of their time were composing these odes, or the, you know, telling each other these stories about their warrior heroes from the past. Well, you know, to us, while Bill Hickok and Wyatt Earp and Bat Masterson and some of the other characters are our warrior heroes, and you also have our warrior villains, and they clashed and they encountered each other. And so that's why we keep telling and retelling these stories, because there are mythical tales that originated in truth, as Iliad and Odyssey did, even though it made changes over time. And we want to, you know, we the Westerns, you know, represent that, those kind of warrior hero stories. We don't see them, unfortunately, as much as, you know, when I was growing up, you had, you know, Bonanza and the Big Valley and Rawhide and Virginian and some of these other shows that were constant, steady diet on television. And you could go to the movies and see a Western double feature at your local cinema or triplex cinema or something like that. We don't have it there as much, but I don't think that means that the hunger is not there. I think it's still there, so that when a book like Tombstone comes out, when you have something like when they make Lonesome Dove, I know I'm going back a few years, but Lonesome Dove really touched a need in a lot of people to see that kind of story. And it's based on an absolutely terrific book too. So that's what I think it is. I think we want to keep encountering the stories, reminding ourselves of the stories of our warrior heroes.
Tom, thank you so much for coming on and spending some time with us and allowing us to reexamine an interesting part of history and kind of look deeper into the mythos of this well-known story. I'm fascinated by it. And like you said, I mean, it's got the interesting elements of true crime with the people involved and the lives. And it is interesting that it's not so cut and dry, really, when you look at it. You know, to the villains, they're the heroes of their own stories. The cowboys, the people stealing the cattle, the people that thought that they were trying to provide for their town were, in essence, creating their own dark element to history. But it just depends on what side of a line you stand on and what side the sun happens to set that day, doesn't it, on whether you're remembered as a hero or a villain.
It does. And you know, who's telling the story, it's that's what I think the Tombstone story is. An exciting story, a dramatic story, but I think it's a poignant one too, because you know, you had some people that ended up not faring very well, who maybe didn't deserve their fate, but you know, some people remember that great line towards the end of Clint Eastwood's Unforgiven, when he's got the shotgun trained on Gene Hackman, and Gene Hackman's character says, "I don't deserve this," and Clint Eastwood says, "Deserves got nothing to do with it." Sometimes that's the way things work out, and you're either on the good side of the legend or the bad side.
Very cool. Tombstone, the Earp Brothers, Doc Holliday and the Vendetta Ride from Hell. That's the book. It's out and available. You can, we do have a link for it on today's program as well, so you can find it. Tom, just out of curiosity, Wyatt Earp, Tombstone, both came out a relatively short amount of time from one another. Who do you think did the best job of telling the story?
I think that, you know, my personal favorite of the two is Tombstone, with Kurt Russell as Wyatt Earp and with Val Kilmer as Doc Holliday. I think most people think of him as the definitive Doc Holliday. But I just started last night, as a funny thing, rewatching the movie Wyatt Earp with Kevin Costner. And I'm sort of reevaluating. I think Costner makes a good Earp. And I think I underappreciated Dennis Quaid's portrayal of Doc Holliday. So it takes a while to watch this movie. So hopefully I'll finish it in the next couple of days and see if it gets more points than I originally gave it.
Very cool. Well, thank you again so much for your time. It's been a pleasure. Get the book, folks. Remember, rate and review the book. When you get it, make sure that you do take the time to just give it some stars, give it a little comment, because that helps these authors so that their books get even more exposure. All right, Tim, it's time to kick open the case files. We've got quite a few this week. It's time now for Dumb Crimes and Stupid Criminals.
It's Crayon News story time.
What happened with this dude, Christ Bearer? I heard he cut his penis off and then jumped off a balcony.
suspect pulls gun from butt, shoots twice at Denver police.
What is your emergency?
I need help.
And what's the problem?
I'm too high.
You're too high?
Yeah.
Dumb Crime, Stupid Criminals is here, Tim. And since we just came off the Wild West, I thought we'd start with this story.
Sure.
A fight broke out in Schuylkill Township Village Thursday afternoon after a horse a Brockton man was riding relieved itself in the middle of Valley Street. The incident happened just before 3 p.m. in the 300 block of Valley Street, Brockton, when state police at Frackville. I wish I lived in Frackville.
Me too. I get away with swearing all the time.
Right. What the frack?
Yeah.
Said William Kellett. He was riding his horse. The horse pooped on the street outside of Joseph Leskin's house. Leskin, age 69, began yelling at Kellett, leading to a brief verbal argument. Kellett began clearing up the fecal matter and left it to dump it in a field when Leskin followed the man on horseback in a Kubota. When Leskin caught up, a physical altercation ensued. Leskin struck Kellett in the face, troopers said, leading the altercation to the ground. Both parties suffered minor injuries in the scuffle. Harassment charges. Now you know where my mind is after being locked in my home with my children for 3 months. Harassment charges were filed for the incident. So this dude cleans up his horse's mess.
Yeah.
And he still gets tracked down.
Hmm.
Crazy. Who was it that was it that song, Rock and Roll Part One, I think it's called. Isn't that Gary Glitter?
Yeah.
Right. And you've seen Gary Glitter, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I think this guy might be his doppelganger, Tim.
Really?
Yeah. I'm not sure. I could be wrong, but I think it might be him. I'm trying to send the picture over to you, but I send me a little high on Fache book. Let me see if I can find you. Oh, there, never mind. I got you. Okay. So let me just send you this cat's picture, and you tell me if he doesn't kind of look like, maybe I'm thinking of the wrong guy, but I'm pretty sure this is Gary Glitter.
Okay.
You ready? Take a peek.
Okay.
Tell me what you think.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he is.
Is that very Gary Glitter-esque?
He's Gary Glitter from the nose up and from the nose down. He's a little chomo. Not going to lie.
Who?
Chomo. He's a child molester.
Oh, chomo. Listen to you.
Chomo. It's jail talk.
Yeah. Waldport, Oregon. I forget how street and urban you are sometimes, too. How much hard time you've done. The Lincoln County Sheriff's Office arrested a Waldport man Wednesday night after they said he called 911 more than 20 times in 2 hours. Before the string of 911 calls, deputies responded to a reported disturbance on the southwest South Maid Lane in Waldport at around 11 p.m. The caller said a man was inside her home refusing to leave. The woman said she had barricaded herself inside her bedroom and could hear the man yelling and banging items around in another part of the house. The first deputy to arrive saw the suspect. Saw that suspect, Tim. Later identified as 39-year-old Timothy Richard Swander, ripping fan blades off the ceiling inside the home. The deputy detained Swander and said he appeared to be highly intoxicated. Hard to tell from that photo.
No.
My God, his eyes are glassy and red, Tim. The deputy took Swander back to his home, where he was cited and released for third-degree criminal mischief and second-degree criminal mischief. Shortly after he was released, Swander called 911 a total of 24 times over the next 2 hours. The sheriff's office said none of the calls were for actual emergencies. In the calls, deputies said Swander made false reports in an attempt to get law enforcement to respond. He also requested medics and would decline them once they arrived at his home. Dispatch warned him several times before deputies responded to his home, taking him into custody. He was lodged in the Lincoln County Jail on charges of second-degree criminal mischief. Words is hard today, Tim.
Yeah, they are.
Third-degree criminal mischief, 3 counts of initiating a false report, interfering with a peace officer, and 24 counts of improper use of an emergency notification system. How much do you think his bail was set for, Tim?
I'm going to go $20,000.
$20,000 for calling 911 24 times?
Yeah.
$442,500.
Wow.
Yeah. I think that's a bit overkill.
They don't like to be bothered over there, do they?
No.
Huh.
No, that they don't. All right, Tim. I've got a story. I'm just going to put it out there. This is going to be our last story. Not right now. I've got more stories to share, but our last story is definitely not one for kids to listen to. So I'm going to put it last.
Okay.
It kind of fits in our weird world of crime. And it's possibly a new drug on the market. And I'm wondering what you might think of it, Tim. I know that you've dabbled and experimented throughout your life.
You're wondering if I want to go out and try it. Is this the deal? Okay.
But first, we're going to start off with a story, Tim.
Okay.
With a vegetarian and vegan slant.
Ah, all right.
Two people have been accused of shoplifting while wearing watermelons on their head.
Hmm.
Yeah, that's taken this whole social distancing thing to a new level, Tim.
Okay.
Police have been on the hunt for two people accused of shoplifting in Virginia while wearing watermelons on their heads. It's not the traditional style of face covering, but you have to respect the thought, planning, and execution the pair went into while creating their disguise. You'd think you would want to be inconspicuous if you were going to commit a crime, not stick out like a sore thumb. But no, they wore watermelons with holes punched out for eyes. The Louisa Police Department uploaded pictures of the incident to Facebook, where it's been liked, shared, and commented by thousands of people. In a statement, the police force said, the town of Louisa Police Department is conducting a larceny investigation and is requesting the public's assistance with identifying and locating the subjects of the photos in the image. On May 6th, 2020, at 21:35 hours, Tim, two subjects arrived at the Sheets in a lifted 2006 black Toyota Tacoma wearing hollowed-out watermelon rinds with holes cut out for their eyes into the store, and they proceeded to commit a larceny. Hilariously, if anyone has any information about the crime and wants to report it to the Louisa Police Department, they need to use the reference case Melon Heads. Even more hilariously, one person commented on the department's Facebook post with a picture of the two suspects at a different store. Who knows whether it was the same day, but they're certainly wearing the same clothes as seen in the CCTV footage. Since beginning their investigation, police have arrested one person. It's unclear whether they are pursuing the other watermelon-wearing suspect in relation to the case, Tim. You know, the backstory on this, Tim. They're just trying to get money.
Mm-hmm.
And steal so that they can turn it around into cash, because with it they cantaloupe tonight.
Oh, God.
Watermelon cantaloupe.
It's a
vegan joke, Tim.
It's terrible.
Speaking of vegans, Tim.
Mm-hmm.
Are you ready for this?
I'm ready.
A reclusive vegan beat his girlfriend with a glass vinegar bottle because she smelled of bacon.
What?
He's been sentenced to a community order after pleading guilty. Christopher Elam, 22, pleaded guilty at Kirklees Magistrates Court to two counts of criminal damage, sending the indecent or grossly offensive messages, and assault by beating of his girlfriend of 4 years, Bethany Smith, age 23. Miss Smith had told the court that she and Mr. Elam had started out as friends before becoming romantically involved back in 2015. At that time, Mr. Elam was neither a vegetarian nor a vegan. Eventually, the couple moved in together in Huddersfield, West Yorkshire. During the relationship, Mr. Elam then became a fanatical vegan, eschewing all animal products, with Ms. Smith telling the court her then-boyfriend pressured her into becoming a vegan as well. According to the comments reported in the Mail Online on Sunday, he became completely set on the idea. He told me bluntly, if you're not going vegan, I'm going to break up with you. The domestic abuse survivor described a controlling and destructive relationship where Mr. Elam cut up his then girlfriend's clothes and harshly criticized her for eating one cheese and onion crisp, with cheese being forbidden in veganism, Tim. Ms. Smith described her boyfriend as a reclusive person and said that he barely left the flat, meaning that the couple were dependent on the money the young woman earned working at her stepfather's cafe in nearby Halifax.
Yep.
Smith then told the court, during the week, I helped out by waitressing, doing the washing up, working the till, and serving customers. I enjoyed the job interacting with people, and it gave me some time away from Christopher. But when I got home from a shift one evening, Christopher was raging. He snapped and told me I smelt of meat. I assured him that it was because I'd been in a cafe around food all day, but he launched into a nasty tirade. He pulled me by my hair into the bathroom, forced me to shower. He called me a fat, disgusting biatch. The next morning, when Miss Smith had to go back to work, Mr. Elam cut up her dress, then grabbed the glass bottle of vinegar off the side and whacked me around the side of the head with it.
Mm.
Good God. Because he smells of bacon. Hell, that's Tim's top priority on any dating site he's ever been a part of.
It really is, yeah.
Single, attractive radio show host seeking someone that reeks of bacon.
Yeah.
And it's really that short. That's really all he's looking for.
I've actually come up with a highly fragrant cologne called Baconator.
Mm.
Yeah, and it's delicious. And
well, hold on. The people from Wendy's are on the phone, Tim.
Oh, yeah?
They're suing for that.
They are?
Because then you're messing with their delicious Baconator sandwiches.
They should be celebrating me, actually. Yeah. I would think we could get into some sort of business partnership here with this.
Remember Burger King released the Whopper cologne?
Oh, yeah. I bought a huge stock in that deal.
How'd you do in that then?
Horribly.
What?
Yeah, I lost a lot of money in that deal. But I've learned my lesson, and I came out with Baconator. Because I feel like people just were turned off by the Burger King product in general. They really were looking for a woman's touch, Dave. They were looking for the Baconator.
I guess.
Yeah.
Speaking of a woman's touch, a Florida woman has been arrested after having virtual sex with her incarcerated boyfriend.
What?
A Florida woman was arrested for allegedly having virtual sex with her incarcerated boyfriend during a video call with a young child in her room.
What?
Noelle Raschetti, 32, engaged in the virtual visit on March 25th with her 26-year-old partner, Tathan Fields, who's serving a 15-year sentence at Santa Rosa County Jail, according to court documents obtained last week by the Smoking Gun. In the video call, Raschetti and Fields pleasure themselves on camera as a child walks around in Raschetti's bedroom her Lake County residence. Good God.
That's ratchet.
She even implements an assortment of sex toys during the virtual hookup. She was arrested on April 22nd and charged with engaging in lewd and lascivious conduct in the presence of a minor. Her arraignment is scheduled for May 18th. Yeah, it's unclear if Mr. Fields faces charges from the incident, but he previously had been in trouble while incarcerated, once charged for masturbating to the female instructor of a prison class, the report says. I just want to know when this guy's going in for his virtual visits so that I'm not the next guy in there.
Oh, yeah.
Since we're in this weird sexual environment of stories, Tim,
yeah,
let's move on to this next one.
Okay.
I know you've done a lot of interesting things in your life, Tim, and I know that you enjoy a little role play. I mean, we experimented in college. And a sex fantasy gone wrong, though. Two men with machetes entered the wrong house in New South Wales, Australia, before realizing their error. One of them has now been acquitted of entering a home armed with a weapon. In July of 2019, Australian media report, they had been hired to carry out a client's fantasy of being tied up in his underwear and stroked with a broom. The judge concluded that the facts of the case are a bit unusual. The role play was arranged over Facebook by a man near Griffith, New South Wales, who provided his address to the hired pair. He was willing to pay how much, Tim? How much would you pay two men wielding machetes to break into your home, tie you up, and then brush you with a broom, stroke you with a broom?
Those are two different questions. How much would you pay and how much do you think he paid are two different things. Me, I wouldn't pay more than $1.95. How much he would pay is probably different.
Okay. So, allegedly, Tim won't pay for being stroked off with a broom, but
especially two guys breaking in with machetes and stroking me off with a broom. No, I'm not going to pay anything for that. Thank you, sir.
I think you are in denial, Tim.
Oh no. I ain't paying.
I think if they looked, I think if these men looked like Tupac and Christian Bale, you would pay big bucks.
Still not paying anything for that deal.
So how much do you think this guy paid for two men wielding machetes to break in and then stroke him off with a broom?
They could be dressed like Mrs. Garrett in the welcome wagon lady. I wouldn't pay anything for that service. God.
How much did this guy pay?
I think he probably paid the $1,000. That's what I'm going for.
$5,000.
This dude needs to seek out help.
He was willing to pay an astounding $5,000 if it was really good. the judge said. However, the client moved to another address without updating the two men. They then entered a home on the street of the original address. When the resident noticed a light on in the kitchen, he assumed it was a friend who came by to make the morning coffee. Oh, how wrong could you be?
Mm-hmm.
And called out the name of their client. The resident turned on the light and removed a sleep apnea mask he was wearing. It was then that he saw them standing above his bed with machetes, which they appeared to have brought as props for role play. When they realized their error, one of the pair said, "Sorry, mate," and shook the resident's hand, according to local reports. The two men then drove to the correct address, where the client noticed one man had a great big knife in his trousers and asked them to leave the weapons in their car. The client then cooked bacon, eggs, and noodles, and a short time later, the police arrived at the property, found the machetes in the car, and arrested the hired pair. The judge ruled that evidence did not suggest the men's actions were intentional. They carried the machetes either as a prop or something to use in fantasy role play. He said the fantasy was unscripted, and there was no discretion as to how it would be carried out. A lawyer for Terrence Leroy, one of the accused, said it was a commercial agreement to tie up and stroke a semi-naked man in his underpants with a broom. Entry was not with intent to intimidate, but rather to live a pleasure. Just when you think you've heard it all, Tim, you get a story like that. And as we wrap up, Tim, here's our final story. This, again, probably not safe for children.
Okay.
A lot of drugs out there, Tim. A lot of things people are willing to do in the name of sex and in love. Here is a an article written by a woman sharing her strange predilection. I'm a woman in my 50s until 3 years ago. I kind of want to read it in that disturbing male Australian voice, though, Tim.
Do so. Yeah, I'd like to hear it in that voice.
I'm a woman in my 50s and until 3 years ago, I lived my life with a general aversion to illicit drugs and alcohol and a sex life that wasn't exciting, let alone enjoyable.
Right.
But 3 years ago, my ex-husband left me, and I began using illicit drugs recreationally.
Uh-huh.
As my life spiraled out of control, although others were very judgmental of me behavior during the period, I personally found it incredibly liberating. I was able to safely discover things about myself that were important to me. And I really valued having the sense of freedom that came with it, particularly when it came to sexual expressiveness. During that time, I discovered aspects of my sexuality and fantasies I hadn't previously recognized.
How tender.
A few months ago, I started a more stable relationship with a man named Boris, who was understanding of my past and supportive. Respecting that Boris seemed disinclined toward my safe drug and alcohol use, I stopped that behavior. However, secretly, I've continued to long for my past alcohol and drug use because of the sexual liberation it gave me. Crikey. Secretly, I started indulging one of my fantasies. I keep Boris's ejaculate in my mouth, discreetly spit it into a kitchen glass, usually the next morning. Then I use the dehydrator and spice grinder to grind up his semen into a fine powder, which I later ingest through a snorting straw. I realize this might sound strange.
Yeah.
Wait, it might?
We went past strange a bit ago. Yeah.
I was previously curious about semen. Seemed to have happily found my own sexual placebo. And it's made me far more sexually expressive and confident in myself when I do it right before sex. Is there anything wrong with this practice? Should I tell Boris? Perhaps more important, are the healthier alternatives to drugs and alcohol to enhance sexual confidence? I think the voice made that story better. I could be wrong.
It did, yeah. It really enhanced it. It hit it home.
I got to tell you this. As weird as it sounds, you got to accredit. I mean, she keeps it, spits it in a jar, dehydrates it, grinds it into a fine powder, then snorts. This woman is committed to this role.
She makes she actually makes making jerky look like a really mundane hobby.
Certainly is. Well, that's a strange story, but I hope that's not a new drug people are going to be out there trying, Tim.
Jerky dehydration or sperm dehydration? Yeah.
Yeah.
It could be jerky dehydration, too.
Oh, that is, in a sense. Yeah. Well, that's it. As gross as it is, we hope you've enjoyed today's Dumb Crime, Stupid Criminals. We'll be back again next week with more of the best in True Crime Talk Radio. I'm Dave Schrader. That's Tim Dennis. This is True Crime Tuesday.